You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So I am personally so excited to have discovered such a fantastic new writer and to be able to introduce her to you tonight. Of course, Goli Taraghi is not a new writer, not at all. It's just that this volume of her deeply poignant and delightfully provocative stories, The Pomegranate Lady and Her Sons, which is one of the best titles ever, is now available for the very first time to an English-speaking audience. This is a wonderful translation by Sara Khalili, and the irrepressible voice of Goli Taraghi is finally available for the English reading audience to savor. Goli Taraghi is one of literature's great storytellers. This is unmistakable. I've already fallen in love with several of her characters, and as the writer Joan Silber remarked, this volume of stories offers, quote, a splendid view of the wild resourcefulness of people coping with restraints. Vibrancy spills from impossible situations. Pain and charm keep trading places. Goli Taraghi is considered one of contemporary Iran's most eminent writers. She was born and raised in Tehran, the daughter of a noted publisher and editor. She received her undergraduate education in the United States and did her graduate work in sociology at the University of Tehran. Among her recent collections of stories are The House of Shemiran and The Three Maids, and her work has been widely anthologized, including in Tablet and Pen, the indispensable volume of writing from the canon of modern Middle Eastern literature, edited by Reza Aslan, who will interview Goli tonight. I know most of you here are familiar with the work of Reza, whose current book, Zealot, is on the New York Times bestseller list. Reza is a board member of the Levantine Cultural Center and a great friend of Aloud. He's also the author of No God But God and Beyond Fundamentalism. He's an associate professor of creative writing at UC Riverside and one of the most reliable authorities on Middle Eastern culture, religion, and politics. We are so thrilled and deeply honored to welcome tonight. Please join me in welcoming Goli Taraghi and Reza Aslan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Goli Taraghi.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome to Los Angeles, or as we Iranian-Americans call it, Tehrangeles. This is actually it's a good city to have this conversation in. I know that you've been traveling around the country with this absolutely remarkable collection. I mean, Louise talked about how amazing the stories in here are. I love this book. I mean, I can't emphasize it enough. The stories in here.
Thank you.
I'm familiar.
Did you hear
that? Yes, it's true. I'm familiar with some of the stories in here, and some of them I'd never read before, and they've become truly some of my favorite short stories of all time. And we're going to talk about some of the stories itself, but I figured since, you know, we're in Los Angeles and you know, we joke about it a lot, but this is a city that hosts a large number of Iranian exiles, that it would be appropriate to begin the conversation with that notion of exile, which is so much a part of who you are as a person, as a writer, so much a part of the themes that you talk about, exile, displacement, the notion of return. What is exile mean to you as a writer and as a person?
It's a terrible thing, I must say. I left Tehran or Iran on 79. It's almost 34 years that I live in Paris. With my two small children, I left. And because I was teaching at the university at that time, and then I was one of those who thought that this revolution will surely bring something fantastic. It's a spiritual revolution, and all the promises will be realized. But right away, university was closed, and I was really, you know, disappointed with things that right away at the very beginning happened. So I told myself, well, I take this opportunity, take my children and go to Paris and live 1 year in Paris and come back. I had no idea or intention of staying 34 years in Paris. Impossible even to think, but things happen in life. You just go along, and then when you look back, you say, how could I do that? How can I endure this, all these things that happen? But when it happens like a river, you just swim in it and go along with it. I came to stay 1 year. I didn't touch anything in my house, but I didn't know things that happen, like war with Iraq. When the war started, I didn't want to take children back. And so I said, I just wait a little. Bozak Namir Bahar Miad, we say in Persian, that 8 years passed. Then it was impossible to take children back and go back. Of course, I went 2 times, even during the war. But I couldn't take my children back, and already it was too late. So it happened that I stayed, and children were small. I had to stay because of them. But for me, the worst part of the whole thing was that I was educated here in America. I spoke English, and I knew the ways and manners and things of Americans' life. But I was completely a stranger in Paris, completely. I didn't speak a word of French. And being in France, in Paris, and not speaking French is a
problem.
And speaking it even badly and with bad accent is unforgivable.
Yeah.
Really. If you go to the bread shop, for example, to buy a bread and say it, you know, with an accent, they give you a bread with accent, you know. So this is exactly. And at the same time, French are extremely sensitive to your appearance. And for me, it's very difficult to keep a very, very neat and good appearance and perfume all the time. And you know. But for French, the boulangerie again, the bread shop. If you just go, you know, very relaxed sort of, you know, and go and give me a baguette, they give you a very relaxed baguette. So it's always I said to my daughter that I don't know why they act like that with me. And she said, that because, look at yourself. You're like a clochard. Put something nice. I said, I cannot put perfume, then make myself high heels to go and buy bread. And she said, this country is like that. So this country was difficult, for at least for a person like me. So especially exile. But the most difficult part of it was that I couldn't write or publish. I have published 9 books in Iran, and I couldn't publish in France. I was nobody, and I felt a stranger within. And
can I ask you? Do you mean that you had writer's block, or that you just simply felt as though you
no,
couldn't
I,
write?
I
that
had
nobody wanted to hear
block
what you had
because,
to say. Right.
Because of the situation.
Yeah.
Because I felt that I cannot publish it. I had no audience to sort of give me energy and love and desire to write. And of course, no, I wrote a lot. Yeah, I wrote even fiction called Strange Adventures of Monsieur Aleph in Exile, which is just myself. Mm. And I lived... this is very important that when you're exiled, if you're exiled in a country, that you don't speak the language, already you are condemned. You are guilty because you are defenseless. You cannot defend yourself. And it is how I understood, this is why I understood the importance of language. Language is like a sword that can absolutely, you know, defend you. And I have written that story about the neighbor. Right.
Yes, yes, the neighbor, there's a wonderful story, and a lot of these stories, of course, are deeply, deeply personal. You can sense the sort of intimacy that is coming out of it, but you're referring to this wonderful story about an exile from Iran and her children in a small Paris apartment with a particularly annoying neighbor, Madame Wolf.
Madame Wolf,
who is always complaining about the noise and the strange smells and... everything that is about being Iranian, and yes, noise and smells.
What
yeah.
smell? You're exaggerating.
we all smell like Fessenjun. And I think what's remarkable about that story, it's something that you're intimating right now, which is the idea that this woman becomes powerless. She can't defend herself because she can't communicate. So you know she can respond, you know, she has an argument to make against this nosy neighbor, but it's only when she finally breaks down and starts speaking in English that her power comes out. So this is
what I say, the language, yeah. You know, here, because French at the same time that they don't like you. They don't even like you to speak English in America.
No, they absolutely. That's even worse than speaking
poor French. Everybody wants to speak
French.
Perfect French, you know.
Exactly.
French is the language of God, you know. So, but when I started to... But at the same time, they're very, very... They have a hidden complex towards Americans and English, you know. If you were speaking English... They sort of, you know, they don't like it, but at the same time, they cannot hide their respect or your superiority. Uh-huh. You know, this uh-huh. is definitely that, uh-huh. you know.
Well, so let's stay on this topic for one moment here, because, of course, you know, for a writer, I mean, it's all about the mastery of language. It's not just about, I mean, obviously, everybody understands the importance of being able to communicate one's emotions and being in a situation in which you can't do that because you don't have a mastery of the language, but it's much more difficult, I think, for someone like you because, you know, you're not just communicating, you know, yourself and your needs, but you're trying to communicate very complex ideas and emotions. And it brings me to a question that I wondered a lot while I was reading this book, which is, how did writing in Paris transform you as a writer? Do you write because you write both in Iran and in Paris. Do you write differently? I mean to say, when you are sitting in your office in Paris as opposed to sitting in Iran, does it feel different? Does your writing come out differently depending on where you are?
No, it doesn't come out differently, but something happens is that when I write in Iran, I have the intention to publish. But I feel right away in Iran, as soon as I start to write, I feel that little man of the censorship department standing next to me and looking down. And my hand trembles because I say, oh, he's going to cut this word. So auto-censorship, you know, starts right away.
You censor yourself.
Yeah, I censor myself. And what the thing is, I don't know what to censor because there is no rule, there is no definite rule.
Very random.
You know. And okay, I never write about religion, sex, and what sex? Never. Even love. I love to write a love story, but love is taboo. You cannot find any love story because love between a woman and a man, if they're not married, is not allowed to be right about it. So they have to be married. But I don't like to write about love story about a couple who are married. You know.
Not interesting.
No. I mean, they might be very happy, good for them.
But it's just not a good story.
Yeah. But a love story has a tragic part in it, like Romeo and Juliet, you know. If you write right away that they are married, and then in Iran, it always like that. I've seen it. Even the women writers. You see, when it started a book, 4 or 5 pages. A girl, a boy, they meet in a cafe. That is accepted because they can imagine that in a cafe there's about this much, you know, space.
There are 50 other people
yeah,
around.
Yeah, I'm not sitting on your lap, you know, in a cafe. So this is this much, you know, distance. And then he says right away that, I like you very much, would you marry me, or something like that. Maybe second time. And she says, I have to think. Nah, 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 nah. And then they're married. The rest of the book is about their problems, conjugal problems, or that she's unhappy or unhappy marriage. But, of course, divorce in a book. In reality, 5 out of 10 couples are divorced, the young ones. But in a book, nobody. They're all married forever. Whatever happens, whatever, if she is, the woman has to accept in a book. A woman must tolerate, stay home, say nothing, woman. And then, so how can I write a love story like that? That I put aside.
Well, but
sex I put aside.
You do have one love story this book, and it's in the Flowers of Shiraz. And it's with children, which reminds me of something about what you're saying right now, because, you know, I think it's universally recognized that the best sort of developing world film in the world is Iranian film. And I think part of the reason why Iranian cinema is so incredible and so good is precisely because of the limitations that are placed in the way of these writers and filmmakers. And so they have to create enormous emotion out of, you know, a relationship between, say, a man and a woman who can never touch, who can never have any kind of physical. So how do you tell a love story in a movie in which, you know, a man and a woman can never touch? So what do filmmakers do? They rely on children. And so two questions for you. Number one, does the fact that you always have the censor in mind,
absolutely,
do you think that makes you a better writer? That having this obstacle, this challenge, forces you to write in a way that actually makes you better?
No,
and secondly,
really.
Is the children's thing in here?
I really suffer because I want to say whatever I want, but I can't. And so actually, even with the subject, I have to decide and change the subject matter. And I'm always conscious of the man, the invisible man of censorship, looking at what I am writing. And in a way, sometimes your imagination, you know, starts to work and you're trying to find, to trick the little man to really, you know, to say things symbolically or to place. I never did that, but a lot of writers place their characters in another country or in another time. But they say the things of today, you know. But it's very difficult. But the thing is, I never write about politics. I'm not a political writer. I don't. This is my temperament. I'm rather a mystic philosopher inside of me. But I have had many times. They called me and they said that Unbelievable. Can you imagine? In one of my first books, Somedeva, he's going out, bang, you know, he hits his head against the door. So this is part of his character. So when he's dancing, everybody is dancing, he falls down two times. So he said, the man to me, you know, this character, Mr. Hashemi, he's drunk. I said, no, when did he drink? Well, I didn't see. He said, yes, the way he sort of banged his head against the wall, the way he fell down, everything, he is drunk. I said, so what do you want to do with him? Kill him or do what? He said, you have to take him out. I said, no, this is impossible. He's one of the main characters in this story, in this chapter. And I said, believe me, he didn't drink. And he said that, you want to say you know better than us?
Yeah, right.
Imagine.
There you go.
How can I say? I mean, this is this sense, sort of censorship.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to comment on something that you said, because I've heard you say it a lot, that you are not a political writer. I understand what you mean by that.
Directly, I mean.
Yeah, but there is, I was going to say, is that there's great deal of political commentary in these stories. I think about the first story here, The Gentleman Thief, this remarkable story that takes place in the immediate aftermath of the revolution. And one of the things that you can't miss when you're reading this story is the transformation that takes place in all of the characters in the physical space. The grandmother in the story says something that I think is just wonderful. She says, the world is upside down, its head is down, its feet are up in the air. The thief character in here, this very polite thief, goes from being a math teacher to a thief, to a guard, to the caretaker of the man whose house he robs. The physical transformation of you know, one of the characters' husband. I'm just going to read this one line here because I think it's marvelous. My aunt's husband was standing in the entrance hall and refused to come in. He looked very pale. At first I thought he was sick, but then I realized that he was terrified of being in our house. It was as if he thought they would confiscate him too. He kept looking at his watch and wanted to leave as soon as possible. I had always had a different image of him. That of a witty and confident man. He was talkative and had an opinion about everything. He wore Western suits and silk ties, and his watch band was white gold. Now everything about him had changed. He hadn't shaved, he wasn't wearing a tie, and he had an old leather watch band. He looked like a faded and altered photograph. It was hard to recognize him. You cannot miss the metaphor.
This story, my darling, was written in Paris. And I gave myself the freedom of saying even these things.
Okay, all right.
Now, the Farsi version of it, which I softened a little, because when the man from the ministry of something, I don't know, I can't remember, comes and says, we have come to confiscate your house. So the grandmother says, so where are we supposed to go? And he says, as far as I'm concerned, you can go to hell. But this, for sure, I didn't write in Farsi.
Uh-huh.
I have already, you know, the version, because I'm going now with a hope that since the President Rouhani said that he's going to allow some writers like me, because I haven't been able to publish anything for the last 4 years of this dear sweet Ahmadinejad, which almost, you know, destroyed everything. Anti-culture, you know, really, like anti-pasta. He was really anti-culture. So, and especially the Ministry of Irshad, as we call it, hate my name. You know, they have put a cross on my name. You know, I'm a woman. I don't have a husband. I live in Paris. Yeah. I'm a free woman. Ooh, this should cut my head.
You are trouble. Yeah.
I am sitting here talking with Reza Aslan without wearing a scarf.
Yeah.
So all this, these are really, if somebody will show the picture, I would be in trouble, you know. So I would say it's a Photoshop, you know.
Which is, that's what Ahmadinejad says.
And you don't say anything
says.
Either, you know.
He tries the same trick.
Yeah.
What you're talking about here is something that is, I think, pervasive in your life. It's pervasive in the lives of the characters that you write about. It's pervasive in your stories, which is this notion of a double life. My favorite story in here is In Another Place. And the main character, Amir Ali, he is a man who has played the game correctly. He has a very fine job. He's connected to a family that's, on good terms with the government. He's got everything that you could hope for to succeed in the Islamic Republic with all of its, you know, obstacles. And one day he discovers that he slowly starts to lose control over his body, and that he even begins to, he becomes somebody else. There's a second person inside of him. He refers to as a shadow person. And he starts talking about this possibility of life in another form, in another place. And not to give the story away, because it's such a marvelous story, but in the end, what he discovers is that this shadow man, far from trying to destroy him, is actually trying to save him. He says, this moment he looks in the mirror, he and that other man stood staring at each other, and Amir Ali realized that this other man was the one who had ruled over his limbs and made his bowels rumble. He was the invisible being who he thought had followed him like a shadow and was at war with him. But perhaps this shadow had not been at war with him after all. He had been a friend, abandoned and forgotten, and hence wounded and vengeful. The image in the mirror was looking at him with friendly, inviting eyes. The two approached each other until they merged, and only a memory remained of the old Amir Ali, the respectable vice president of the Yarn and Spool Company. And it's only in that moment, when he abandons the veneer of this incredibly successful life, I mean, he figured out a way to make this thing work for him, that he truly becomes happy.
But he hates from the very beginning. He had, you will see that his friend says that Amir Ali that we knew was someone else, always dreaming of another sort of life, always adventurous. He wanted to be free, to go to travel, to do so many things. He's almost an artist, something else. And then he has fallen into this married life. That first of all, he is a puppet in the hands of his wife. He hates his job. He hates the way, you know, his house. Everything is decided for him.
And he's got a great job, a marvelous house.
Yeah, but he hates it.
But he hates it.
Yeah.
He hates it.
He hates all the objects, you know, antiques in the room, in the bedroom. And then he always dreams of a simple life with where he can sleep looking at the skies. But this is exactly, every time he looks up, he sees this huge, big, you know,
chandelier
hanging down. So he's living a lie. That's the whole thing, you know. And everything is a lie, and he lives this lie till he's incapable himself to change his life, till his body revolts, as if there is a hidden enemy inside of him, but it's not an enemy. It's a brother who saves him at the end, you know.
In a way, this sort of double life, this hidden life, I mean, that pretty much sums up most Iranians, doesn't it? In a way, that's, I think, how most people in Iran live, the sort of double life, a public life and a private life, the life of giving
in to
the system.
In the case of Amir Ali, it's like a mental problem. It's very inward.
Schizophrenic.
It's sort of something very existential, you know, for one person who lives, you know, this double life. But in reality, if you see, in reality, I have always lived a double life. Mm-hmm. Always. I have lived between two worlds. Even as a child, my family was divided, you know. My part of my mother was a very modern, you know, part. My uncles were in Europe. My mother would look like a French Hollywood actress, really beautiful, always, you know, smelled perfume. It was good for her to live in Paris. And she went to Paris always, you know. My father could afford, we were a rich family, you know, well-to-do. And then the other side, my father side. My father actually was trained to become an Ayatollah. And because my grandfather, paternal, was an Ayatollah, and my aunts lived in city, holy city of Qom. But my father actually, he threw away, he said, his turban and everything, and decided, like Amir Ali, this is not life for me. He adored, he always believed in modern life and in science. And when Reza Shah came, nobody had a name. And Reza Shah ordered everybody to choose a name.
The last name, yeah.
Yeah, the last name. And my father chose the name Taraghi, which means progress. So my name is Goli, means flower. I'm a flower of progress. And his very close friend, who was also belonged to a religious family, he chose the name Tajaddud, which means modernity. And so Mr. Progress and Mr. Modernity are both hand in hand came to Tehran, and the daughter of Mr. Modernity lives in Paris and is a writer, and me too. So my father really believed in science and everything, and he was the only one. But the aunts, my aunts, and then when they came every summer, they stayed with us, and my father always said, "The wolves are coming, beware." So there was always, you know, my mother, you know, always a smile, the coldest possible smile, and said, you know, welcome them. And the aunts came, you know, the wolves. And then one of them was sweet and adorable, and I loved her. And she was, both of them always were telling me that I live a corrupt life and my mother will end up in hell, and so I shouldn't follow my mother, and I must pray 5 times a day. So they made a small chador for me, and praying 5 times a day, no, it's difficult, one time. And then even I kept half of the prayers, I would say, but God knows the rest of it. Why should I continue? Yeah. And I said that, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and then I ran to play. I ran to go out with my mother. You know, my mother went to Lalazar Street, which was full of clothes and perfume and things like that. And my aunt. So I was always, you know, French say déchiré, split, you know, between these two worlds. This from childhood stayed in me. When my father, at the age of 15, called me and said, when I came from home, I didn't have any money. I made an empire for myself. You and your brother must go to America and make your own life. So I went to America. Don't ask me where, because you always probably will say, why? Why Des Moines, Iowa? Of all places. Well, it just happened. It's a long story. My brother was there, and he was a masochist. So he from Washington, he went there. It was a good university, though.
Yeah.
And then there's this magazine, I still have it, Goli Taraghi in Des Moines, Iowa. It was a big event, and they came and they interviewed me. It was my first interview, and I said the most stupid things possible. And anyway, I was there, but I tried to become American, but I couldn't. First of all, I didn't have, you know, I was short, mignon, not short. You know, in French they say that, little one. And then all these American boys, I hated that sentence always, who passed by and said, "Hi, shorty, how's the weather down there?" And, you know, what does that mean? I mean, I had never heard that. I hated it. So I felt like E.T., you know. You know, looking always in at the sky, home, home, you know. But I, you know.
So that sense of exile was a very early,
very, very early
idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So even if I, you know, wore white, you know, stocking, and, you know, tried to imitate American girls with a ponytail, and I was chubby, and it was all superficial, and I suffered, you know. And I always tried to have a little Iran of myself in the home, and my mother came in and stayed with me. We made, you know, the fesenjan with the pomegranate, and all the Iran, and I played me Iranian music, but it's very, very difficult for me. Till I spoke English and everything I learned, and I went to the university, but I always stayed Iranian inside of me, and I wanted to return. This, why do I love Iran? This is also a question that I have to find out even today. Mm-hmm. I long to be back, but now it's sad, because when I go back, of course I have my house. That's my little Iran, my family, mm-hmm. my friends, my house with a little garden. But outside is another world,
yeah,
completely. So again, in Iran, there are two worlds. Again, you have to live between two worlds, inside and outside.
And outside, yeah, you know? Private and public.
Yeah, because inside, as you can do it inside, you have, if you have a swimming pool, you have your bikinis, you play your own music, you do whatever you want, mm-hmm. completely. But then you want to go out. You have completely changed like that.
Yeah.
You put stocking, scarf on your head, your long uniform, and then there are different rules and that you have to respect. And jumping from one world to another, it's not as difficult anymore.
Well,
we have learned somehow.
Yeah, it creates, as you were saying, it creates sort of this double identity, this sense of schizophrenia. But I mean, I think it also is instructive of a larger truth about Iran, which is that it's a country of great contradictions. And this is, I think, especially true when it comes to women. Obviously, you know, women, legally speaking, are marginalized. They certainly don't have the same rights as men do. I think the general impression of Westerners of Iran is the place where women are violently, you know, suppressed. And yet, women make up the vast majority of the college students. Yeah. There are far, far more female writers and artists and musicians today than there were before the revolution. And especially female writers, some of the best poetry, some of the best fiction coming out of Iran is coming out of women. Why? Why do you think that is?
I've been asked these questions, and I have my own answer, but maybe it's not the answer, the right answer, because I believe that with this revolution, the revolution encouraged the women to come out and join the men and scream and say, you know, to be part of the mm-hmm. army of...
Down with the Shah.
Down with the Shah. So women came out, even, you know, women in without scarf or anything, a lot of women, you can see the films, the students, everybody, mm-hmm. women came out. And so after the revolution, well, I talk about especially because the Iranian women writers come from lower middle class. So they, when they came out, they didn't want to go back they didn't want to go back home and sit and make cook like before or obey their husband, but they had discovered that they are somebody. They and special identity for themselves. They were part of the revolution, they were out. So they didn't accept anymore to hide themselves under a, you know, black chador. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted their right. And women somehow started, you know, by different ways to assert themselves. And asserting was one way of writing, painting, playing a musical instrument, singing, be active, be out in the society. And that is how really suddenly we discovered so many artists, writers, painters, photographers. There are really many, many, many. Mm-hmm. And don't ever compare Iran, for example, to Saudi Arabia. For example, young women are so modern, you cannot believe mm-hmm. the way they dress, they drive, they even drive taxis, they, you know, they they had car racing mm-hmm. for women. The women participated in many, many different things. They're extremely modern. And especially the women work, for example, in never we had so many women work in ministries, in hospitals, mm-hmm. as a teacher, because first of all, they have to support their family, you know. And so the women are very active in Iran, extremely, mm-hmm. in different mm-hmm. levels.
Mm-hmm. I want to open it up to the audience for questions, and I believe that there's a microphone that is going to be passed around. So please just raise your hand and someone will bring a microphone to you. And you can go ahead and do that now. And while that microphone is coming to you, I just want to ask one question that I'm just very interested in is about sort of the writers that you read. And I don't mean in English or in French. I mean, I can really see Nabokov, you know, in your writings. I see a little bit of Salman Rushdie in your writings. But I'm curious, what are some of the...
Salman Rushdie, no.
Never. Don't say that, no.
It's forbidden.
This isn't recorded, is it? This isn't... It's not recorded, yes, okay.
I'm curious, to Tehran soon.
What Iranian writers do you see as influences in your writing?
No, nobody influences in my writing, really. Not that I'm going to be very, you know, self arrogant, but the classic writers, the men writers, they never influenced me before the revolution because
like Jamal Zadeh and these
guys. They're not my type at all.
Right.
At all. Even Hedayat that I admire.
Yeah.
Never influenced me in my writing. And
Sadek Chubak, these guys?
No, really? They're very Iranian. The way I write, I have nothing against it, but really their language is completely different.
Yeah.
They, as you can see in Farsi, I don't know if you have read my things in Farsi. Finally, I created a language because I was educated in Europe, in America, and I read a lot of foreign, you know, literature. I try to create a modern language for writing. And men writers before me who were also very important were mostly Marxists and gauchists, you know, leftists. And the way they write, they write whatever they write about Savak, Shah, prison, and mostly about peasants, about the workers, about the misery of the lower class, which is very good. But I didn't experience these. It was not my life. When I wrote my childhood memories and it came out, it became a 10 times bestseller right away because they said, first we discovered a writer who doesn't write about, who's not poor.
Right. Yeah.
Who says that his father had a car. I wasn't afraid to say that because he had a car. What can I say? He didn't have a donkey, but he had a car, you know.
I understand.
And we had a big house with a garden. We didn't live in a village. And we lived in a most expensive part of Tehran. But what is important that I did not appreciate, sort of, I made this sort of a very semi-modern family bourgeoisie, almost, I mocked it, you know. I mocked my uncles, I mocked, especially writing about my father that I adored, but I was, you know, also very tough with him because he was very tough with me too. And so everything is, my mother who was so coquette, who was so Frenchy, I made fun of her, you know. I never appreciated this sort of a very modern life, which was at the same time comic, you know. When we bought our first refrigerator, we put it in the salon, and then my mother insisted I play piano. I hate piano. I have a daughter who is a pianist, but I hated piano. Mm-hmm. I was a tomboy. I wanted to play with boys in the street. And so they bought not only a piano, but a huge big piano, royal piano. But my piano teacher was Polish, and she was always drunk, and whenever she came, She sat there and she cried and cried and cried and cried. And she told me, she was a Jew, and she told me how she lost her daughter. And I started to cry too. And then I knew that mother comes and listens, and I said, bing, 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 bing. Father insisted that, father was against the piano playing, wanted English. A modern girl must speak English. So he hired an English teacher for me, which was Indian. And from this Mr. Ghazni, we learned everything but English. You know, because when he came to stay with us in our house, he was a very poor guy. I don't know where father found him. I don't know, in a garbage can? Where? Because he was so dirty. And then first of all, we sent him to under the shower, and father gave him clothes. And then father said, sitting on the table, you know, on a table, and father said, whoever speaks Farsi with Mr. Ghazni, I will, you know, because father paid us money, pocket money, and he had a little notebook. And if we made a mistake, he wrote 10 tuman, 2 tuman, 1 tuman, you know, to deduct from our pocket money. At the end, I always, you know, owed him something. And then I begged him. He said, no, 20 tuman, you have 25 a month. So next, it will go to your next pocket money. And the cook, our cook was the same. If he made, the food was not good enough, even the watermelon was not red enough, you know, everything. So everybody, you know, went under his...
in that little black book of his.
Yeah, in that black book, you know. So...
Who's got the mic? Oh, yes, Thuri.
Salam. I wanted to know, I understand your book was translated into English by someone else. Is that right? So how was your collaboration? Did you collaborate? Because obviously you speak English. So, thank you.
Kudum kitab, Reza?
Haminin kitab.
This was?
Yes.
Uh-huh. In,
yeah, any tarjuma
yes,
showed
yes.
the Few, English
yes, yes, yes. It is true because this book really took 6 years of tolerance of Ellen Mason because she loved...
Ellen Mason at Norton.
At yeah. Norton. She loved one of the stories that she had read in an anthology. And she sent me an email, do you have something for me or for us? And I started with Words Without Borders.
Yeah.
Till and then... She kept asking me for shorter stories. When the shortest stories, after so many years, were finally selected, she said, no, I want one voice, one translation. So Sarah Hariri, who was a very good translator, but started with my cooperation because she was afraid. She wanted to stay very faithful to the translation, and... But I had the freedom to change the words, to, you know, to select certain sentences, or even to censor certain sentences, which was impossible to translate into English, and it would become ridiculous. So we collaborated together, and she was really faithful, and she was really devoted to the translations. So finally, it was finished after 2 years.
The translations, by the way, are, and I've dealt a lot with translations, it's fantastic. It really is a wonderful translation. The sentences are so clean, so elegant, and you don't know. It doesn't feel like you're reading
this
translation.
Because translating me is very difficult. I write in a simple way, and I have a lot of sense of humor. And translating sense of humor is very difficult, you know. Try to translate a joke into another language. It becomes, you know, nobody laughs. It becomes stupid, really, you know. Iranian jokes that we just, die. If when I translate it, everybody looks at me. That's not even funny, you know. So, and especially words, you know, every word in any language has a cultural background and has a special meaning. And that's a special culture. And to try to find, you know, the words that somehow, you know, is near or gets close to the meaning, original meaning, is very difficult.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Sorry.
Hi. Since Salman Rushdie's name was mentioned, I thought I should say this. I was here last year and during Salman Rushdie's talk, and I was arrested.
Again, Salman Rushdie.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I enjoyed his earlier writing until he became Orientalist. But in any event, I came to the talk, and after the talk, I was arrested by the Los Angeles police here because I was an only Iranian here who was attending a Salman Rushdie talk. I had been arrested before in Iran, and actually not long before I went to prison in Iran, I had read your Joy Digar. So given that, I want to ask you two questions. How does your experience living in Paris, one of the stories in Joy Digar, is about traveling and this journey on an airplane. How does that experience comes to being in your writing? And my second question is, how do you identify? Do you identify as a French-Iranian, Iranian-French, or Iranian?
Well, I answer your last question because it's easy. Of course, I identify myself as Iranian writer, as Iranian altogether. I have lived in 34 years now in Paris, but not an inch of me has become French. And French is like on a very, 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 very thin surface, you know, has touched me. I am viscerally Iranian, you know, more than you, more than even my mother, more than my father. I don't know what's wrong with me, but... That's how I am. Even when I go to Iran right now, Tehran is not the same. Tehran is like an old woman that has a beautiful old woman now. You see the, you know, when you look at the beautiful woman, you see the hidden beauties here and there. But it's a memory mostly. Iran is it reflected in my memory. Now we talked of Salman Rushdie, we might as well say this. Salman Rushdie says that for those who have lived abroad many years, like an image reflected in broken glass. It is true. It's just fragmented, you know, broken. It's distorted. It's not the same thing. But still you find one small part of it, even distorted, you still love it. It's a memory that you see it, and you cherish that memory. A lot of things, of course, in my house, for example, around it, in front of it, behind it, were the beautiful gardens, my garden is there. I have kept my house and my brother. But we are like, you know, all the single house behind us, next to us, front us, they have sold it, people, and they have gone. And they have right away, you know, built, constructed very, very high, you know, 50, at least 14 or 15 floors, mm-hmm. buildings. So my house is there, like a child who enters into the elevator among
mm-hmm. high-rises, among yeah.
people, or Lilliput, you know, like a Lilliput, you know, in a giant country. Every single day, every single day, 100 times they come. We want to buy your house. We don't sell. One of them this time said that, but eventually you will. And I said that eventually I will not. This house, eventually he wanted to see you will die. And I said, I have given this house to my children, and they are young, and they keep it, and we will not sell it. I really cannot think of one day that we sell these houses, but we are surrounded by giants, mm-hmm. really, that they looked down at us, and we were there. For me, that is Iran. If I sell that house, Iran is finished. Mm. But at the same time, Iran is small part of the family which is left, which is my brother, who lives in Tehran. That is Iran for me. because my mother is not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And my friends, few friends who come, who live in Los Angeles, who come every summer to Tehran. And when we are together, the family, that is Iran for me. Mm-hmm. And sometimes something which happens only in Iran, that is Iran for me. For example, I took a taxi. I didn't have my money. I had forgotten my money. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't have any money. He said, don't talk about money. It doesn't matter at all. And then when we to the destination, finally, I wanted to come out. He said, but what can you do without money? So let me give you some money. And he gave me, you know, some money. He gave me $5,000 2 months. And I said, but how can I give it to you? And he said, oh, we will meet one day. Don't worry about that. It's just that you get safely, you know, you could come back. So I said, this is Iran. This is home. This is home. Mm-hmm. Because in Paris...
Yeah, that's as far as you need to go with that. Yes, go ahead.
I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about language. You mentioned that you'd read a lot of foreign literature and that probably influenced you, and you wanted to make your use of writing in Farsi larger. But the Farsi language, as far as I know it, which I don't know it very much, but it isn't very precise about certain things like gender parts and other things that you... It's very elusive. It's not very specific. So I'm wondering how you... Did you create new words in Farsi? Did you use foreign words in your writing? And then my second question is, did you make peace with the French language?
Right. No, not at all. I don't use foreign words at all. This is the difficulty, real difficulty. Because Persian language is a very poetic language. We are the nation of poetry. We have had poetry for 2,000 years. And our language is a language of poetry.
It's true. I mean, our sentences rhyme.
Right, like, right, right.
Weird.
We're weird. But this is what I say, that I love to write in Farsi. It's a challenge. And finally, I have succeeded, really, to write in a simple, poetic language. And I never use foreign words, never. And even, you know, I try. Sometimes I love Nabokov, for example. I said, can I say these things in Farsi? How can I? And I try to imitate. How? Because sometimes, you know, Nabokov or even Salman Rushdie, they sort of 10 words, you know, follow each other and make a sentence and brings life to the language. But in Farsi, that's very difficult. That is really difficult. But I've tried it. I've tried it and I have succeeded. So it's possible. And fortunately, yes, you're right. I wrote all my stories in a way that it was difficult. One great difficulty is that in our language, we don't have he or she. And that makes it very difficult, you know. For example, when you say, in French, even if you don't say it, but by the verb, ending of the verb, or the adjective, you understand that it's a woman who said it. But in Farsi, you don't have that. And you have to constantly, if you mention the name of the two characters talking, it becomes extremely ugly. So I have found a way, a special way, like a recipe, my own recipe, mm-hmm. you know, for writing.
And do you do any writing in French at all?
No. No, nothing, not because I cannot. I don't, my French is not that, you know, well,
yeah.
After 34 years.
Yes.
Thank you. Goli, your descriptions of your relationship with the censor are so interesting and comical, you know, poignant. I don't know if it would be acceptable or if it would even interest you, but I'm just curious, have you ever written a story in which the censor is a character, and would that be acceptable to the censor?
That's a good idea.
Maybe hold on to that one. Yeah.
Yeah, but not yet.
let's see how this Rohani does first.
Hi, pleased to meet you. You mentioned well-to-do. Does your family perceive you to be a well-to-do woman? That's a woman that's able to take care of her family.
Is the microphone? I didn't hear.
Yes. Does your you know, you were talking about how you come or came from a very wealthy upper-class family, and I think the question is, does your family, do they see you now as also sort of well-to-do in the life that you live
in Paris?
You,
no, because I am not well-to-do. And, you know, first of all, when we came from a very extremely, I don't hide it, wealthy family, but with the revolution, we lost a lot.
Yeah.
For example, all the inheritance, you know, of lands, everything we lost. Except that they allowed us, my mother, me and my brother, to keep the house. But all the money, my brother's money, or everything was blocked, you know. We couldn't touch it, not at all. So when I came to Paris, actually, I sold my house. And at that time, I could, you know, I brought the money out. And with that money, I bought, you know, an apartment. No, one thing which saved me, because I could afford before the revolution, and it was easy to send money out, and it was not the rate of exchange so expensive, I bought an apartment. I bought an apartment, and a very luxurious apartment in the heart of the Paris. So with this, what happened, having that apartment saved me. Mm-hmm. Saved me up today, because I sold it and bought a smaller apartment in another, you know, district. And so I lived, you know, I lived with the money, actually. So my family, they don't look at me as being, no, they always worry how I live, you know. But still, as I managed.
Yeah.
But you say something very interesting, that gentleman over there. He said he was arrested. I didn't hear well, because he talked about Salman Rushdie.
No, I think what he was saying, if I'm not mistaken, was that during the Rushdie event, he was picked up by the Los Angeles police as being, I think he said, the only Iranian.
Here?
Wasn't the only Iranian, because I was the one interviewing Rushdie. So,
uh-huh.
But I guess, you know, I don't look as dangerous as he does. As opposed to the year before?
Yes, because it was after the film, the video that had caused the riots.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Well, you do look suspicious, sir.
Hi, yeah. You were talking about living a double life, and I'm kind of interested, since you have intimate knowledge of Iran. I lived in Iran for a little while. And I'm fascinated always by the long tradition of Iranian literature, you know, and also philosophy, although, you know, back to Cyrus the Great and Khorosh Bozorg and then up through Khayyam and Hafiz and up to Shamlu and all these people. And also the Zartoshti, you know, the Zoroastrians, you know, this long tradition, and how much of that sort of liberty tradition still exists, and how much of that is allowed to, you know, exist in Iran now? Is there a sort of a freedom underground in Iran?
No, that for the time, you know, at the very, very beginning of the revolution, they like, during the fascism or Nazism, they decided to burn Hafez. And then when they had the books, you know, I don't know, maybe even they themselves didn't dare to.
Yeah.
Because people, you know, were shocked.
Yeah.
For Hafez is like now, if you burn Quran, how they were shocked themselves. For us, Hafez is sacred, you know. Often we, you know, we sort of kiss it and put it on our forehead. Yeah. So this really, you know, at the very beginning, but it didn't work at all. Now, on the contrary, now after 30 years, Hafez and all the great, you know, Ferdowsi and all the great ones are really, you know, cherished, and they speak even of old, of Iran, of Ahmadinejad wanted to something, you know, to bring the old
Persia, mm-hmm.
you know, and he didn't know, of course, he didn't have the knowledge, because when he was asked in television by somebody in France or something, what do you think of Darius the Great? And he said, I don't know much about him, but they say he wasn't a bad man, you know. that much, you know. But now, really, you know, there's a big, big respect for all the poets and, you know, especially the classic poets, because it is something so deep-rooted in Iranian soul that you cannot take it away. Or New Year's Eve, you know, is Zoroastrian, or even before Zoroastrian, but we say Zoroastrian. It is our New Year's Eve. It's one of our contrasts, because when for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, we cry, we beat our chests and everything. So, but our New Year's Eve is Zoroastrian. You know, mm-hmm. these contracts are very strange in Iran. And I know somebody who knew Khomeini and said that Khomeini wanted, you know, maybe to stop.
Yeah, he tried. He tried.
And even his own wife has said that if you do that, I will, because we have a, you know, ritual, and then we set a table and we plant seeds and everything. And she has said that I do it, and if you dare, you do, you dare you to stop me. So he couldn't. It's impossible. All the rituals of New Year's Eve, Friday, the Wednesday before the New Year's Eve, that we have the big fire and we jump over the fire. It's even more emphasized, maybe some sort of reaction. Mm-hmm. But all the celebrations, all the rituals regarding New Year's Eve for 15 days are more today, more emphasized, more even exaggerated. A lot of Iranians say that started to say, to change and say, we are Zoroastrian, we were Zoroastrians, and then the Arabs came and changed us and imposed this religion on us. So these are more reactions, mm-hmm. you know.
Are they wear the chador?
Yeah. Wear chador?
The Zoroastrians wear the chador?
No.
They don't have it?
No, but if they live in Iran, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, even if you come to Iran, I mean, not you. Yeah, your wife.
Maybe you.
But we do have chador is now actually is a. It's, those who wear chador are the. By tradition, you know, mm-hmm. they used to wear it from in a family. It's not something, you know. It's a chador that they always wore as like a dress, as a part of their dress. But it's a scarf. Scarf that you have to.
Yeah, head covering.
Head cover, but you know, well, I don't care. I put something like this, and I wear this, for example. But the girls, for example, they put long red, orange, green, God knows, chiffon, and they put it here, and it's hanging down, and it's so beautiful. And tight, the neck couldn't even breathe, and blue jean. And if they see somebody, sometimes they come to look how they dress, they pull a little, you know, the corner of mm-hmm. the scarf and put it on their head, and then right away it goes away. And this is, you know, this is not a real veil, you know.
I had a friend and colleague, Tom Lutz, who is a friend and colleague of mine who went to Iran last year, and he said the thing that just completely blew his mind was that when you go to D.C., all the statues are of politicians and soldiers. When you go to Tehran, all the statues are of poets.
Hi, I'm also Iranian. Can you talk a minute about
the pomegranate that's in your title. My mom, when I was in my 20s, she planted a pomegranate tree, one in our front yard, one across the street. And when she drives, this was here in the States, she still goes and she visits these trees. We live in a whole other city now. So can you talk about the pomegranate and the symbolism?
Yeah, the importance of the pomegranate in Iran.
In Iran, this is very symbolic. It's, even if you, in ancient, you know, even a lot of paintings, you see the pomegranate, even in table of for New Year's Eve, they always put the pomegranate. So it played a lot, pomegranate as a heavenly and, you know, symbolic. This is called the heavenly fruit. Because inside of it, when you open, all this, you know, is extremely, you know, you wonder what is inside of it. And no fruit is as beautiful as pomegranate when you open it. It's full of these red, shiny seeds that are just like jewels. And they used to say that the juice of pomegranate is the juice of youth, or it gives you long life. There are a lot of stories about pomegranate. Mm-hmm. And the pomegranate lady, of course, it was the lady Anari that I met in the airport. And this was really her name in Farsi, pomegranate lady. And I said that, why do you have this name? And she said, I didn't have any name. And my mother died she was from a village in Yaz, and she said that, Khanum Jun, dear lady, when my mother died, they put me under the pomegranate tree, and they gave me, you know, the juice of pomegranate instead of milk. So I became Nanny Pomegranate. Mm-hmm. And then her father also had a name of a tree, Chenari. And I said, well, why your family is this? Is it Chenar? Are you saying English, Chenar?
Cypress.
Cypress?
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's your father. Because she said, next to this tree was the cypress. So that was my father, that was my mother. And when I went to get my identity, you know, certificate, I said that my name is Pomegranate, and my family is this. So she asked me to help her to go to Sweden. And this is the whole story.
Don't give it away because it's such a heartbreaking story. It's the title story of this extraordinary collection, The Pomegranate Lady and Her Sons, which Goli would be happy to sign at the end of this conversation. Thank you so much
so
for
much.
Coming
Thank
out
you.
This evening.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.